Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On March 11, 2003, in Brownsville, Texas, one of America's poorest cities, John Ellen Rubio and Angela Camacho murdered their three young children. The apartment building in which the brutal crimes took place was already run down, and in their aftermath, a consensus developed in the community that it should be destroyed. It was a place neighbors felt that was plagued by spiritual cancer. In 2008, journalist Laura Tillman covered the story for the Brownsville Herald. The questions it raised haunted her, particularly one asked by the sole member of the city's Heritage Council to oppose demolition. Is there any such thing as an evil building? Her investigation took her far beyond that question, revealing the nature of the toll that the crime exacted on a city already racked with poverty. It sprawled into a six-year inquiry into the larger significance of such acts, one so difficult to imagine or explain that their perpetrators are often dismissed as monsters alien to humanity. With meticulous attention and stunning compassion, Tillman surveyed those surrounding the crimes, speaking with the lawyers who tried the case, the family's neighbors and relatives and teachers, even one of the murderers, John Allen Rubio himself, whom she corresponded with for years and ultimately met in person. The result is a brilliant exploration of some of our age's most important social issues, from poverty to mental illness to the death penalty, and a beautiful, profound meditation on the truly human forces that drive them. It is disturbing, insightful, and mesmerizing in equal measure. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Long Shadow of Small Ghosts, Murder and Memory in an American City, with my special guest journalist and author Laura Tillman. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Laura Tillman.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Incredible story. Again, just an amazing, another slice of Americana that we knew nothing about. Incredible. Let's talk about how you came to be involved with this. Let's talk about... You say that you were about midway through your first year as a newspaper reporter when you walked to the apartment in Brownsville, Texas, where a couple had murdered their children. So tell us, before this investigation, how much you knew of this. It wasn't really your forte, but what did you know about this crime before you came to this assignment? And then tell us about this assignment in the first 6 months as a reporter.
So I knew a little bit about it, mainly from the other reporters in the newsroom at the Brownsville Herald where I worked. It was a case that had really haunted the community of Brownsville, and some of my fellow reporters did tell me about it. There was a file cabinet in our office that I remember was filled with pages of documentation from the first trial of John Allen Rubio. And in that filing cabinet was a copy of his written confession. And I remember reading that and finding it really disturbing and difficult, especially because there were all of these tiny details of things that had happened that were so specific, and it just made the crime really come to life in a difficult way. So that was kind of the first time that I started hearing about the case. And then as time went on, I was sent to go to the building where this crime had happened because of this debate of whether or not it should be torn down. And that visit made a big impression on me right away, mainly because it seemed like people were suddenly voicing these questions and concerns that had something to do with the building and the case, but really had to do with much more profound meditations on the meaning of that case in their community and their lives, of what it said about their town that something like this could happen there. And this question emerged of whether the building itself was sort of being blamed for human crimes, and also whether there was a parallel to be found between the execution of this man, John Allen Rubio, on death row and the destruction of this apartment building.
Now, at the time you have this assignment for our audience, for the timeline, because we talked about in the introduction that there's a couple trials, at this point, where are they in terms of in between the first or the second trial appeal? Where are they at the time of that assignment for you to look at this potential demolition of this haunted building?
I believe at that point, John had been sentenced to death during his first trial, but then had won his appeal because his common law wife, a woman named Maria Angela Camacho, who also was a participant in the murders, had the attorneys for the prosecution had entered into the trial a videotape of her answering questions from detectives. And because she didn't testify, there was a ruling that John won on appeal because his defense team was never able to effectively cross-examine her. Because of this, John was granted a second trial, but it took some time for that to happen. That didn't actually happen until 2010. So we're talking about 2008 when I was writing about the building, which was kind of midway between these two different trials.
Now, you get back to the building and your assignment, and there's the outside of the building, and you interview people, neighbors. You talk about Minerva and another gentleman. So you ask them about the building, what they think, what their impressions are. And you also talk about, interspersed through this whole story, but you, in the very beginning, you lay it out, the history of Brownsville in terms of poverty. You lay it out where they are in terms of the status of the poorest in America and its proximity to Mexico. So tell us where it is close to, and tell us a little bit about Brownsville so we can set the stage for this story too.
Absolutely. So Brownsville is at the southernmost tip of Texas. It is, if you sort of look at a map and you look at where Texas meets the Gulf and meets Mexico at the very bottom, that's where Brownsville is located. And it has been ranked at off and on as one of the poorest areas of the country, if not the poorest area of the country at times. It's a historically disenfranchised area. There's no medical school in Brownsville. There isn't a law school in Brownsville or for 250 miles around within the United States. So it's an area where the best and brightest have been kind of subject to a brain drain, where they often leave and go to Austin or go to other parts of the country looking for higher education or better jobs. So that's part of what contributes to it. It's a very beautiful area geographically. There's it's a sort of a subtropical area. It's not, when people picture the U.S.-Mexico border, I think a lot of the time they picture the Sonora Desert in Arizona, or they picture the deserts around El Paso and Juarez. That's not what we're talking about when it comes to Brownsville. This is a fertile river valley. There's a lot of citrus, sugarcane grown here. It's a place where there are lakes and palm trees interspersed among the houses. And there are also different parts of the city. Not all parts of the city are as poor as the section where this crime takes place. This crime takes place in an area called Barrio Buena Vida, which is translated as the Good Life. Ironically, unfortunately, this is one of the poorest areas of the city and therefore of the country. It's a place where a lot of the crime centers in Brownsville. It's a place where there are a lot of transient people who are on their way somewhere else, who are very vulnerable. And it's also a place where drugs and prostitution kind of center in the city as well.
Now, when you looked at this house, and I know people might believe, and you may believe that you would feel something in this sight of this horror, but tell us a little bit about your impression and some of the interviews, and what the neighbors like Minerva had to say about either this building being haunted or should it be demolished. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the building, which is, there's a photograph of it on the cover of the book, actually. If people are listening and want to get a sense, you can just Google it and it'll come up. It's a very unattractive building, I think, in virtually every way. It's a two-story apartment building that's white, but over the years has been left in disrepair. It's kind of a filthy color. It's at times had, there were small improvements sort of made on it over the years, if you could call them that, as I was reporting on this. But when I began, there was a staircase on the back that was sort of halfway falling apart, doors and windows that looked like they had kind of fallen apart years ago and just been left to deteriorate. This is actually building in one of the central areas of the city. It's just blocked from the federal courthouse and the police station and the county courthouse and, in fact, the newspaper building. But I think it's carried different legacies over the years. When I talked to Minerva about it, a lot of her memories of the building were from her childhood because it had been there, you know, as long as she'd been alive. She'd been living in that house her whole life and was very used to it. But it had kind of turned from a place where humble shrimpers and their wives lived, where there was a gas station at one point and a small store, to a place that was one of the cheapest places in the city to live, but was not kept up, and had become a place because of the murders that was kind of haunted by that legacy. I remember an instance where I was finally able to go inside the building, and Minerva told me to get some holy water. So there was a sense that that not only was the building kind of haunted by the murders, but that the people who surrounded it and who came into contact with it were also similarly haunted or sort of affected by it. People said they heard the sounds of the kids screaming at night and things like that. And it just had become an eyesore on the community. At the same time, this is a historic building. Because of its age, it has some historic status in Texas, and that gave it a measure of protection. Really, without that measure of protection, I wouldn't have written a book at all, because I think the building would have been destroyed long ago. But because of its historic status, there was this sort of necessary bureaucratic debate over what funding could be used to demolish it, whether they would need to document it in some way, whether there was an argument to preserve it and turn it into something else. And that really fascinated me, because when you see something that so many people have written off as not only just unappealing and unattractive, but in fact perhaps haunted or cursed, and then there's this idea that you could go beyond that and you could turn it into something that would actually help people prevent the kinds of crimes that had occurred inside. It seemed like such a revolutionary concept because it was just so far away from the way that most people perceived this place. So I think that was a big driving factor for me in the beginning of writing this, was really to question, well, what do we do when these crimes occur? Is there some sort of constructive way of making meaning out of them instead of writing them off as simply horrible events that come and go? Is there a way to act in the spirit of prevention instead of destruction? And I think that goes back to also the way that we look at prisoners in our country. Do we try to genuinely rehabilitate them? When we look at criminals, do we act in the spirit of punishment or rehabilitation? And in a way, try to appeal to the best of ourselves, our most maybe naive hopes for how we could make the world better. And so one of the things I think I confronted when talking to people was a question of whether I was just being naive in my pursuit of those answers, or whether there was really a chance for something good to be made out of this somehow.
Now, in that pursuit, you have to do, as you talk about, an exploration, and a full exploration as a journalist. You have to talk to as many people as you can. You say that you were kind of surprised that you did have a correspondence with John. So tell us how this came about, and just tell us what you did to get him to agree, and then were there some conditions? Did he have conditions? Did you have conditions? Tell us just a little bit about that first beginnings of the correspondence between you two.
Yeah, so I wrote a letter to John. When I first started writing this book, I was really focused on the building. And then it kind of expanded out from there. But I was really just focused on the building itself and kind of the question of its fate. And when I wrote to John, my initial questions for him were about life inside of this building and what he remembered about it, and whether he thought of it as a sort of good place for his family to live or not. I think when you see the building and when you see the apartment that they lived in, it's so bleak that for most of us, it seems like a horrible place to live. And he talked about it with gratitude and the sense that, you know, his family was happy, which is, I think, a complicated issue also, is the way that he kind of rewrites his own history and puts rose-colored glasses on a lot of the things that happened even before the murders occurred. But I wrote to him, you know, asking a few questions. He wrote back saying he would answer my questions, but that would be the end of our correspondence. And then once that exchange occurred, I continued writing to him, and he continued writing back to me for a long time. And it was sort of surprising at first to get these letters from him and to see that he was so willing to talk about things. He had said at the beginning that he didn't want to talk about the crime itself, but even that in time, he sort of volunteered his thoughts and feelings about, in a way that was the part that I was least interested in talking to him about, because there's just so much documentation available, not only of him testifying about the crimes, but of many other parties who investigated and analyzed them. So for me, I was mostly interested in his life, who he was, how a person from childhood eventually becomes a person who commits a crime like this, and whether there was any sort of hope of finding measures that we can look at that might prevent more of these kinds of things from happening. There weren't any conditions per se, but one of the things I was most concerned about was making it very clear to him that our subject was one of our relationship was one of journalist and subject. And when I wrote to him, I didn't write him the kinds of letters that you might expect someone would receive in prison, letters to keep them entertained or to connect with them on a sort of human or emotional level. My letters were really lists of questions that were designed to be a long-term sort of interview process between me and him. And, you know, there were some moments along the way when, for example, he asked me for a comic book for his birthday at one point, and I had to kind of clarify and drive home the fact that, you know, that didn't really fit in with the relationship that we had, because I think for someone like him who, you know, has been around the media covering his case but hadn't engaged with many journalists before in an interview sense, that he was still a bit unclear about what that meant.
Right. Now, in these letters, you encourage him to speak the way he normally speaks, and so you have these and you provide these, and this, one of the more fascinating parts of the book is this really revelationary, whatever, what he reveals in this correspondence. Important part of this is the culture that you talk about, as well as the curanderismo, I probably mispronounced that, but also how important that was, at least it seemed, in John's life and his mother's life and his family's life. So let's talk a little bit about this superstition and talk about his mother Hilda, and also talk about just his early life and what you discovered.
Right. So curanderismo is this kind of folk healing practice that I think that the equivalent people might be more familiar with is the idea of a medicine man in our country, that there is a person who is a healer who has certain abilities and also certain herbs and remedies that they dispense to other people. So if you're going through an illness or depression, or if you're praying about something, you might seek this person out to help you. And that's an important part of the culture in Brownsville and on this part of the border. There's also this kind of inverse version of that called brujeria, which is more equivalent to witchcraft, which is a negative version of this, in which someone is actually cursing other people, putting the evil eye on them, helping people to maybe manipulate others in different ways. And so both of these were present, I think, in Hilda and John's lives. Hilda, John's own mother, was believed by some in their family to be a bruja, witch, to practice witchcraft. And this was something that from a very young age, John sort of saw in his family. And one of the psychiatrists who evaluated John and Hilda found that instead of doing what she said a good mother might do and kind of discouraging him from certain superstitions, illusions as a young child, that I think a lot of us have when we're kids, maybe we're playing with a Ouija board or we get sort of nervous about a person in our neighborhood that we think seems creepy or things like that. Instead of sort of reassuring him that everything was okay, she kind of fueled these delusions and beliefs. And that was something that this psychiatrist believed to eventually turn into grander delusions as he got older.
From an early age there, he is diagnosed with certain mental afflictions, and his IQ has been tested at 90, and you say it goes down to 72 by a certain fairly young age. And then there is talk about him not being able to discern at an early age fantasy from reality as well. Just tell us a little bit more. You say that what I thought was fascinating is that the family is living off, this very poor family is living off the disability that he gets because of his illness at one point.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions. Unfortunately, Hilda did not agree to be interviewed by me, and I wish that I could kind of hear her side of the story, because one of the things that happens in a courtroom in terms of the mitigation phase is that the jury is presented with kind of all the horrible things that happened to this person in their lives, including his really difficult and awful childhood with these abusive parents and a mother who is a drug addict. But, you know, that is kind of the extreme version in some ways of what may have actually occurred, and we don't have any kind of balancing factor to hear, you know, what was Hilda thinking when she encouraged these delusions or agreed with these delusions? But one of the things that you can't help but wonder is if she might have encouraged those delusions because it ensured that they would get these checks that were keeping their family afloat, that, you know, her son was diagnosed with an emotional disturbance, and because of that, you know, that they were eligible because he was in special ed and all these different things to get some assistance. So that's one of the difficult things, you know, looking back, and one of the things that I most wish is that I could have spoken to her to really understand more of that context. But from what we know, John was delusional. He talked about seeing things, hearing voices to his siblings. The way kids do, they might have just agreed with him that they heard him too, to sort of be in on a ghost story or thinking it was kind of fun, while for him maybe these things were more real or genuine that he was hearing and seeing. And one of the other things that the psychiatrist that I was talking about, who talked about Hilda, mentions is that John had this kind of superhero complex that he developed, where because he felt so powerless in his life, he started to sort of pretend that he was much more powerful than he really was, that he had great abilities to do special things. And later on, this belief was referred to as this idea that he was the chosen one, that he had some kind of divine mission from God. And that's an idea that kind of manifests when we look at what actually happened in their apartment.
Now, back when he's a child, he looks like he's got a fairly normal life. He's got three siblings, two of his own brothers, and then a brother from previous. But his mother resorts to crack. Hilda, at some point, her priority becomes crack. So there's people in his life that try to intervene, the swim teacher. He belongs to ROTC. He's not very good at school, but his dream is to get into the military. But what happens with his dreams, and what does he really become? He meets a woman named Gina, and she has a child. So what happens with his dream? And in terms of ambition and jobs, occupations, what happens with him? What does he do?
Right. So John, from a young age, was interested in joining the military. He was compelled by their slogan, "Be all that you can be." As he gets older and is in high school, he meets a woman named Gina who has a couple of kids already. She's about 10 years older than him, and they start a relationship even though he's still a high school student. Then when they break up, John starts smoking a lot more marijuana, and he starts huffing paint more heavily. He's pretty depressed about the breakup. And then he starts, he starts pursuing the military and taking the exam for entry and failing it over and over and over again. And this is really devastating for him because he didn't have another plan in mind. And at that point, John is really taking a lot of drugs. He meets Angela, who is the woman who will become his common-law wife at that point. But just to sort of outline, I guess, a bit more what happens to his dreams and what happens to his job prospects, he's doing things like working at fast food restaurants. At some point, his mother suggests that prostitution might be a good money-making option for him.
Sure.
Which is extremely disturbing. And he's just kind of floundering and, frankly, imitating the behavior that he saw when he was growing up among his mother and her friends in terms of taking drugs and kind of floating from place to place and job to job. And it's an extremely troubled time. The other thing that's so difficult about this time, I think we can say in retrospect, is that for most people with schizophrenia, this is about the age when that first emerges, when people have their first episodes. And that fits in very, very nicely with John's age when he's graduating from high school.
And to exacerbate this, which isn't a big leap, he likes smoking weed. Well, okay, but huffing spray paint. And he likes huffing spray paint. He thinks this is sort of mind expanding for him. So,
right. Yeah. That is extremely detrimental to John. And I think that you can see, as you mentioned earlier, when you see these IQ scores that just sort of plummet in those few years, it's very obvious what the culprit is for that. You know, he's damaging his brain cells on a regular basis. And while in high school there was his swim coach and there was ROTC and there were people watching his progress in special ed, when he's on his own, graduated, he's kind of just, you know, had no parental or adult figures in his life to see what he's doing and try to steer him, you know, on a better path. He's just a kind of immature, even for his age, teenager, who's now self-medicating and is using drugs as a way to escape, as a way to entertain himself. And it's just, everything's just kind of starting to form into this perfect storm at that point.
You talk about the extensive research you looked into, the CPS workers coming to the family and into the home and seeing the conditions that these, now they have three children, young children, in this home previous to March 2003. So we'll say early in 2003, late in 2002. What are the CPS workers seeing? What are the conditions there? And the living conditions in terms of how many people are living in how small an apartment. And the thing that I wanted to mention, because this I thought was unbelievable, later you ask, geez, I didn't really see a window. Was there a window in this entire apartment that all these people were living in? So tell us about those conditions.
Yeah, it's really shocking. And I think it's amazing that people are, you know, living this way in our country, to see this kind of poverty that in this area is even a step up from how they were living before, because at one point, you know, John meets this woman named Angela who already has a young daughter and is pregnant with a second child. They get together, and then she has the second child, then they have a third child. together that's both of theirs. And at one point, they're homeless. They're sleeping on a mattress in an alley. They're sleeping in abandoned buildings. And CPS comes and sees these conditions and gives them a kind of choice of whether to, you know, bring the children to a relative's house, in this case, Angela's mother, or to take them away. And they choose to bring them to Angela's mother's house. But eventually, after they get the kids back, they find this apartment in the building that we've been discussing. And it's this apartment that at one point was the first floor of a building that was designed to be a gas station. And so the first floor of the building was never really meant to be apartments. And when it was split up into apartments, it was just sort of cut into these hallway-shaped units. And that's what accounts for there not being any windows, because you have an apartment that's sort of a hallway in the middle of a bunch of other hallways. And there's a door on the front and there's a door on the back. And there's a little window, John told me, that you couldn't open, but you could open these doors, and that was sort of the only source of exterior light or air. They didn't have any kind of air conditioning, though they did have a fan. And as I said, there's no way to open a window. And this is South Texas we're talking about, which, you know, during the summer, which is about 6 months out of the year down there, the temperature is often over 100 degrees. It would be a really, really difficult place to live, regardless of the fact that this apartment was also inhabited by many people. There was a couple, John and Angela, their three kids by the end. There was Hilda, John's mother, at times living there, sometimes with a boyfriend. There was a transgender prostitute living there with them named Lorena, who at times had her boyfriend, Pinguino, come and stay, or would even bring men back there at times. So it was this very, very full place that was filled with, you know, junk that they'd kind of collected, videotapes, porn magazines, just a really, really desolate place, and not a good place to raise kids, certainly. But, you know, the mission of Child Protective Services is to keep families together. And this apartment, the fact that they had found an apartment, the fact that John had found a job at a certain point was doing drug testing, that the parents were taking parenting classes. They really were doing a lot to try to show that they wanted the kids back. And so even though this apartment was, you know, very troubled, I think the version of it that CPS saw before their visits ended wasn't as crowded, probably was cleaner, and maybe seemed like a safer place for kids to be.
At the same time, though, you talk about reports of the children having insect bites and it just being filthy. Now, the day of the traumatic, incredible event, what was the reason why? Well, maybe we should go back a little bit here, because according to John, he has been really huffing this paint. He loses his job at the Golden Corral, and there is a problem with food stamps. So tell us a little bit about this confluence of events that happens, and then why are they going to the hospital, and tell us about what happens, how they get to this hospital, but tell us what was happening before in terms of his drug use and huffing.
Yeah, so at one point there was testimony that John was on a kind of two-week binge, just huffing paint, you know, every day, and not sleeping, not eating. And then they get a notification that there's a problem with their food stamps. It's not clear whether the problem was that they would be totally cut off, that just one of the kids would lose their food stamps. This was unfortunately one of those pieces of evidence that just sort of went missing, that didn't seem to be in any of the documents when I tried to find it again to just really understand exactly what was at stake. But there was a problem with the food stamps that was clear, and they needed to go and get the Social Security number for one of the kids. They believed that they could get that at the medical center. And so John goes and he asks a sort of friend of a friend for a ride, goes and knocks on the door of their house, and he knows they have a car. They drive them over. The family just sort of seems despondent, and they get to the hospital. They don't seem to be able to locate what they're looking for there. And then they take the bus back to their neighborhood and end up in Market Square. While they're on the bus, it seems like John is getting more and more paranoid. And he thinks that another child is trying to hand one of his kids a poison piece of candy. And then when they get off the bus, they see a woman who he believes has what they call the mark of the beast on her forehead, that she has scratches on her forehead that indicate that she's evil, and that she gives them a certain look, which they interpret as the evil eye, that she's cursed them. I should say that this idea of the evil eye, the mal de ojo, is one of the more sort of accepted and common cultural concepts in right. that area, that, you know, even when I was working at the Brownsville Herald, if someone would admire my outfit and they'd be looking at me for an extended amount of time, they felt they had to go up to me and touch me to sort of diffuse the look that they had just given me. You know, this is a common belief. In any case, those are kind of the events that start leading up to what happened.
Now, we haven't talked about Angela at all, but you do talk about this, and your attempts later to try to interview her, she refused that. So, but you talk about that a journalist named Mireya Villarreal interviewed Angela on camera in 2007. What was she like? I guess you looked at that, you reviewed that. Mm-hmm. What did she note in that interview about her behavior?
You know, I'm trying to think about that interview. I mean, I know that Maria corresponded with her first, and that she conveyed to me that she found her, and I think you can see in the tape that Angela just has this kind of childlike quality to her, even more right. so than John does, that there's a sense of naivete. I think also that, you know, Angela in the second trial and since then has tried to make it clear that she really didn't have as much of a role in the crimes as maybe was once said or believed, and that really John was the one responsible. So that's something that's kind of changed over time, and the account for that, what accounts for that change is unclear. Part of it, I think, could be that, you know, when this all happened, John and Angela were really in love, and that she was kind of captivated by him. And after the crime occurs, you can see that her first instinct is to kind of protect him, because in part because she has a very low IQ, and I don't think she totally understands, you know, the extent of what's going to happen to them or to her. But later on, she's not so quick to sort of come to his defense or to try to help him by claiming more responsibility.
Now, we're not going to go through this, every detail, but to show at least some veracity to this, the psychiatric claims of insanity, and again, we won't be able to go through how they examine that in court and what's the test of insanity, but just for the layman's, for their value, according to Angela, around 7 a.m., what does John do with the family pets there?
So John kills the hamsters that they had, which is just that. That's one of the first details. When I was saying earlier, I remember reading his confession and just being so kind of unhinged by it, because you have this detail, these hamsters, and you're thinking, what? How does this, you hear about crimes on the news, man kills his wife for having an affair or, awful things, but then to hear something that just seems so bizarre and kind of disconnected from what comes next. So he kills the hamsters with a hammer and some bleach, and because they're acting strange, they're sort of supposedly acting like they're possessed, and that's sort of the first step in this long day in which he kills the three kids. It's debatable how much she assisted him in that act, but where he starts to believe that the different kids are possessed, and he eventually goes on to choke them and stab them and decapitate them. He thinks that one of his daughters is speaking in the voice of his grandmother, who, as we discussed earlier, he always thought was a witch. So there's this kind of, and there's also a strangeness to the events in the sense that, he thinks the first two kids are possessed and they're killed, but the third one, he's asleep for a while, and then hours later they do the same thing with him. They also become convinced that he needs to be killed too. And then they walk to the grocery store to buy some milk, which I think is another detail that, to me, he walks to the grocery store to buy milk, which would ostensibly be for something they'd buy for their kids who are now dead. There are a lot of things that go on that are just horrific and so not of a piece with this man who, though irresponsible and using drugs and kind of going nowhere in his life, has never physically abused his kids before, kind of knows, I think, that you can cut and run on your responsibilities from the examples in his life. So there's this idea put forward by the prosecution that they felt they needed to kill the kids because, he wanted to escape and go start a new life elsewhere. But to me, that doesn't really make sense because he could have easily done that regardless.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you too. And the prosecution followed it up with that John had bisexual affairs, and so they pointed to one person in particular and built a theory that he killed the kids because of financial pressure and he was going to go run away with this lover. But again, I didn't really see that holding up too much myself at all.
Yeah, it feels like a very thin theory.
Sure.
At the same time, it's undeniable that he killed the kids and did it in this extremely brutal way, and also immediately, when the police arrive, confesses everything to the best of his ability to remember it, which I think also when you read his confession, when you read transcripts of his videotape confession, he says things like he thought that it was a 72-hour time period that they were in the apartment, which makes absolutely no sense given the timeline, and is the kind of thing that only, I think, someone who's in this kind of psychotic break with reality would find reality so distorted at that point that they could think many days have passed.
Yeah. A touching part of the book is that the mortician was able to put, incredibly, the bodies back together, and they had a funeral. The children looking like little porcelain dolls, which was very vivid imagery.
Mm-hmm.
7 weeks after this murder, this Dr. Valverde saw John and diagnosed him as a paranoid schizophrenic. But let's get to your correspondence, because, again, you said early in this book and laid it out that you didn't want to just have an account of these crimes to, recounting of the details or an easy depiction of somebody as a monster or just to carry on the myth of what may have happened. So what did you find in your correspondence? What did you talk about? But what did you discover, again, when you asked him about his children, when it talks about remorse? Again, you didn't initially get into this, but what was your sense of who he was in terms of his love for his children, in terms of his actual mental illness? You corresponded him for quite a while. Tell us about that.
It's hard because, John's been medicated for a long time. By the time I started corresponding with him, he's been on medication specifically for schizophrenia, and he's really kind of leveled out. So he's still deluded. People with schizophrenia often do have these kind of delusions of grandeur. There were certain things that he said to me at times, that he was kind of the one who held his family together, and that without him, they've all sort of gone in different directions, which the fact that someone could not be self-reflective enough to realize that it wasn't really just him not being there, but the fact that he committed this horrible crime that caused this rift in his family to occur. So he has some kind of ideas of himself that don't necessarily square with reality, but at the same time, he was, and I include big sections of his letters in the book because I think that when you hear about what he did, it's so difficult to have any kind of empathy for him as a human being. And then when you read these letters, he's just so human and sort of non-threatening, and he has had such a difficult life and has had, hopes and dreams, many of them very humble hopes and dreams, that maybe he would have a house and he'd have a family and maybe he'd join the military, which, most people, if they want to join the military, are able to do. So it made a big impression on me, I would say, just to get these letters and to hear his voice. And part of the way I structured the book was to put the crime about halfway through because I wanted people to read and hear these letters the way that I did before you really hear the full extent of what he did, so that you can kind of weigh one against the other. And I think some people walk away and they just still don't really feel any sympathy or empathy for this guy. What he did is too terrible, and maybe he's not self-reflective enough about that, or his reflection doesn't feel authentic to them. But I think for a lot of other people, you read these letters and you can't help but kind of feel transformed. That someone who's among the worst criminals that we have in our society could also be someone who's so vivid and real, and who's also had such a difficult life. That for me was one of the really important challenges of this book, I think, was, you know, that in our world, a lot of the time, perpetrators of crimes have also been victims of crimes at different points of their lives. And how do you square those two things? How do you look at a person and see both of those things at once and not try to sort of divide everyone into two different categories?
Right. And his attitude, as opposed to, again, we talk about a death penalty. You talk about the death penalty state of Texas and the difference in other death penalty states in terms of the practicality of the inevitability of somebody actually being put to death, Texas being much different. And normally you'd have all these mitigating factors, and it seems like those mitigating factors didn't matter in this case because of the horror that this inflicted on the community. But at the same time, he didn't have the attitude that a lot of these other killers in trying to deny his responsibility. Tell us a little bit about how he felt about this death penalty and punishment for what he had done.
I think at different points he's felt differently. You know, right after the crime, he actually, during the first trial, he said, you know, if I'm found guilty, then I don't want to present any kind of mitigation. I just want to accept the death penalty, and I want to join my children in heaven. And so, you know, he was sentenced to death, and that whole section of the trial that would normally occur didn't happen. And then in the second trial, by then, I think that, you know, he'd been on medication for some time. He'd been on death row for some time. He'd had time to grieve, and his thoughts on it had kind of changed, and he wanted to fight, you know, for a chance at life in prison. And actually, the law had changed between those two trials. During the first trial, if the option of life without parole was not available to the jury, but during the second trial, actually, it wasn't made available to them either, because he was kind of still considered under the law as it had stood when he committed the crime. But by the time of the second trial, another person who would be up for a similar case would have the jury given the option of life without parole. And I think even though in reality, someone who commits a crime like this would never be given parole by a parole board, that idea, the sort of abstract idea that you could one day allow this person to walk free, is too disturbing for most jurors. So they are kind of pushed toward giving them death, or have been pushed toward giving them death.
You corresponded with John for quite a bit. Why did you feel it necessary to visit him, and tell us about that visit?
That's a good question. I think, you know, there is a very unequal power dynamic in that relationship. And I had read a book called The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm when I was, right. I'm sure you're familiar with, and a lot of your listeners are familiar with. But just to sort of talk about it very succinctly, you know, one of the things that Janet Malcolm is analyzing in that book is the inappropriate nature of the journalist Joe McGinnis's relationship with, I believe it's Patrick McDonnell, for the book that Joe McGinnis wrote called Fatal Vision, in which, you know, Joe McGinnis is kind of manipulating this man into thinking that he's still writing a book about his innocence, even once he's changed his mind and starts writing a book about his guilt. And so that was a real guiding light for me, I think, when I was writing to John, and just through the whole process was trying to you know, not just not manipulate John outright, but really try to think about, like, what's the responsible way to conduct this relationship? Because it's so easy when someone is in a position of absolute, you know, powerlessness to take advantage of that and to benefit from that, because you're the person writing to them, you're their lifeline, maybe you're the one who could help them get a new trial, if depending on what you write. And I just tried to be really clear with John, make him no promises, but also I still felt, as I was writing him letters and receiving letters, that, you know, that it's so easy to sort of write what you want about someone when you never have to see their face or look in their eyes or really fully digest their humanity and you know, that there's a person on the other end and that you're writing something that really could shape their life or their death, or how they're remembered. And so I just wanted to go, I think, for that very simple reason and see him and talk to him in person. And also, you know, I think as a reporter and a writer, you want to be able to describe someone accurately. There's a difference between being in conversation and just seeing a videotape. And so for all those reasons, I just really wanted to actually have that experience of meeting him.
Now, in terms of this idea that you would visit him, out of this book, I don't know if I guess I could get the sense of, did he understand or care about his depiction in this book? You just didn't really mention that at all. So, what was his take on that? Did he want to scrutinize the book, did he agree to the interviews knowing the full scope of what might be done with the material? Or did he care?
You know, I told him that I was writing a book about him and the building and his case, and I asked him so many questions over the years, so I think that he got a sense of the kinds of things about his life I was most interested in.
Right.
But, you know, he just didn't seem really that inquisitive about it, which, again, I have to wonder is maybe a symptom of schizophrenia, that there's sort of a lack of being able to see beyond yourself, and that, you know, even when I visited him, he asked me very few questions about myself. Even, you know, I'd been writing to him for years, and part of it was because I had kind of very carefully kept it a depersonalized relationship between the two of us, that I wasn't in the habit of sort of offering up information about myself and my life in the letters, but, you know, he just wasn't that inquisitive about that stuff. And he, that I, you know, eventually found a publisher and that it would publish. And I think he was happy, because, you know, even though this book, I think, is not a flattering book about him in a lot of ways, you know, he does a lot of horrific things in this book beyond the crime. You know, he's not a good, responsible parent. He's doing drugs. He's, you know, really engaging in some very dangerous behaviors. At the same time, it was an opportunity, I think, for him for the first time in his own words to kind of tell the story of his life, because up to this point, everything's been really written about him and about his case, but never really engaging his perspective on any of it. He wasn't able to testify during the trials, strategically, because that was a decision that's typically made in these cases by the defense team. And so, yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that. At the, I wanted to add, though, that once the book was published, I got a letter from him saying that he understood that we were not friends and that I was a journalist and he was a subject, but that this book for him was like an answered prayer, which was not something that I was my sort of goal in writing it, was to answer his prayers, but you know, he seems to feel very positively about the project, so.
Well, you treated him with a measure of humanity that he wasn't getting from the entire community, and I'm pretty sure the jailers weren't giving him it either. In conclusion with this, what, again, we spoke very in the beginning about, well, possibly, what could we learn from this? What could we anticipate in the future from this story? I won't ask you that kind of question if we could really get that clear-cut points to consider and that this won't ever happen again. But this confluence of conditions, circumstances, mental illness, drug use, poverty, the history of the community, superstition. What did you come away from at the end of this book with? What was the biggest lesson or thing that you learned from this complex event that can't be looked at in a one-dimensional way? What did you take away from this entire event?
I feel like I learned so many things from the event itself. I was looking for meaning, I think, initially in the wrong place. That is to say, I don't think that an event like this is meaningful. I do agree with people when I think people kind of reacted to me with some measure of disgust or concern that I was kind of so interested in finding a purpose or a lesson out of the event. I don't think that the event itself is meaningful, but I think that there is an opportunity once the dust has settled in cases like this, because sadly, you know, I think a lot of communities have seen a case that was a real trauma, a real collective trauma that went beyond just the people involved, that there are constructive things that we can do to work together to make meaning out of our future, to sort of take something like this and work toward prevention. And, you know, as you say, I don't think it's sort of a direct correlation all the time that you can say, you know, if we do this one thing or we can prevent these crimes unilaterally from happening. I don't think that's fair also to the people involved, because then you're sort of pointing fingers at, you know, the CPS agents or the families. And I don't think that it's fair to kind of directly point a finger at them for a crime that they didn't commit themselves. No. You know, they didn't intend for things to manifest in this way. But I think that, you know, one of the things that happened in the aftermath is that the community planted a garden behind the building and they named it after the kids. And since then, community gardens have popped up all over the city. There are, you know, hundreds of people who are growing vegetables for their families, who are selling them at farmers markets, and who are making more income. And that's not the kind of thing that you can say prevents murders. But I think that there's a lot of subtlety to the way that people come together make each other feel cared about and valued, make each other feel like if they have a problem that there's someone to turn to, that there are resources available for them, and to sort of also keep an eye out for the most vulnerable people in our communities and see how they're doing and if they need help. You know, there's a lot that can happen afterwards that can be positive, even in the shadow of something so dark and painful. And I think the mistake, or the mistakes, maybe to not the right word, but the trap is that it's so painful when these things happen that people want to forget, they want to erase, and they want to move on. And they don't want to dwell inside of these events and contemplate them and contemplate the future in the light of them. And so that's kind of what the building has forced the community to do in Brownsville, that there's this memory that's just stuck around and forced people to kind of reckon with this crime over and over and over again. And I just think that there's value in that. I think there's value in the aftermath, and there's value in thinking about things that are really, really hard to think about.
I agree completely. And it's, you talk about the community garden too. It's appropriately named Three Angels Community Garden in the memory of Ulyssa, Mary Jane, and John Stefan. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this incredible book, The Long Shadow of Small Ghosts, Murder and Memory in an American City. Thank you very much, Laura. For those that might want to contact you, find out more information about your work, do you do Facebook? Do you have a website? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so you can find me on my website, lauratillman.net, and I'm also on Twitter at L.A. Tillman, T-I-L-L-M-A-N. And you can find more contact for me.
Well, thank you very much, Laura, and it's been good talking to you, and have a great night. Good night.